me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Just Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer. Our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. You know, journalism is the practice of collecting, verifying, and reporting news and information to the public through various media outlets in order to educate people, helping them stay aware of important events and issues. Mate David Cheruschuk, a journalist with experience in both broadcast and print media, including work for the New York Times, The Guardian, and The New Statesman. He spent over 20 years in commercial television, covering international issues and making documentaries in the U.S. He has worked for networks like ABC, CBS, and CNN. Since 2012, Cheruschuk has been a producer and a correspondent for PBS, focusing on ethical issues. He's been honored by Britain's Royal Television Society and its Social Documentary Award, and by the British Association for the Advancement of Science with its Television Award. Today, we learn more about David through his memoir, A Question of Paternity, My Life as an Unaffiliated Reporter. He also hosts a weekly public radio segment and writes an online column called The Media Beat. He's a graduate of Oxford University, and he has been a U.S. citizen since 2002, currently balancing life between New York City and Ireland. David, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Jules. Thanks so much for inviting me on your show. And it's great to be on a show that calls itself He's Just a Social Worker. I have a lot of time for social workers, and I'm familiar with that put down of a phrase. You know, the Royal Television Society Award that you mentioned there was some time ago now, but it was for a particular series, a limited run series of television documentaries I made, 6 1-hours entirely devoted to the work of social workers. And we called it, perhaps, you know, with that old put down feeling to the word sometimes, we called it the do-gooders. You know, that was the phrase that British people often applied to social workers, and we thought we'd play with it. I mean, it was ironic for us as a title, the do-gooders. It has that put down feel, but the truth is they do good, these people. And that's why we called it that.
Listen, it's a total honor. And before we got on, I was just amazed at your length and body of work. Tell us a little bit about your journey and your walk. How did you get involved in this work?
I became a journalist as a kind of prescription for an illness I thought I had. When I was at college, I was still a very nervous, excuse me, this is nerves playing a part here and now, I think. I was a nervous kid. I was anxious. There was a lot of uncertainty about my early life. I didn't know who my father was. And that's one of the main themes of the book, my search to discover who my father was. It was always a big secret. But in terms of how I was when I got to university, I mean, I had this almost crippling shyness. I was terribly withdrawn, and I couldn't stand it. I wanted to be rid of this shyness, and so I joined the university newspaper. I thought if I became a reporter, I would have to go out and talk to other people, no matter how intimidating I found them to be, and a source of my great reserve and shyness. So that's what I did. I first of all became a beat reporter, pounding the streets of Oxford looking for stories for the student body newspaper. And then I eventually, over time, I became the editor of the paper.
Mm. Amazing stuff. You know, a couple of seasons ago, I had a man who I look up to a lot. His name is Danny Slomoff. He talked about the myth of public speaking. Oftentimes, we're caught up in between how we sound and how others are receiving this information. And I can tell you, I have an accent in both Spanish and English. And sometimes when I'm trying to convey information, I'm surely trying to measure my speed and breath. And sometimes those things play with one another. But tell us a little bit about, you know, getting in between the ethical pieces of this. What do you think are some of the challenges that journalism is facing today from the ethical side?
Oh, boy, journalism has always been challenging to do if you want to do it properly. But it does. I mean, you're right to ask the question in terms of the current climate of today. I think the digital revolution has changed the landscape completely. Almost everybody is a publisher now. It's not as if newspapers and network owners are in control totally anymore in the way that they used to be. Almost anyone can get on the internet in one form or another. Social media is perhaps to the fore of this phenomenon. People can become their own journalists, their own broadcasters, and there's been an extraordinary torrent of all this material now, and a lot of question marks about how reliable it all is. Does everyone who feels a need to speak out publicly, do they all check their facts before they announce them, or statements they might make might be facts to them, but they wouldn't be classed as facts by a professional journalist. And, you know, I think that gives us a huge problem. I think the professional journalists of this world are now constantly looking over their shoulder and concerned about what is flowing out there, and puts them in a position all the time being the double checker, the fact checker all the time. Mm.
When I talk to my students, I got middle school students now, and I talk to them and I show them a newspaper. They're like, what is that? Like, this looks like X-ray paper. It's so different how life has changed now, people using technology to kind of get their information. Interesting, to say the least. Aside from that, how do you think journalism has changed throughout your career? Because you've covered so much in various ways, not only in the digital or the social platforms, but more around the trajectory of the nuances of the profession. What has changed?
Well, it's not new. I guess the change started in the 60s, 70s. There was something that was, it's funny to think of it now as a label, but it was called the new journalism. People like Tom Wolfe, particularly a great New Yorker, was labeled as a proponent of this new journalism. All that meant in its time was that the journalism was highly personal. The reporters that I'm thinking of, not just Tom, but and he became a novelist too, a very successful novelist, following the same technique, really, the new journalism was putting the reporter at the center of the story. Now that, for someone like me, coming from a much more traditional mode of journalism, is kind of horrifying. I'm not the story, I'm the reporter of the story. But that's one of the big changes that started then. And of course, now we get to exactly what I was just talking about. Everyone can be their own reporter. Everyone can be their own broadcaster. And that makes the landscape really unstable. In the end, you have to, as a consumer, be very choosy about who you consume, whose writings, whose statements, whose broadcasting you consume. You need to be very careful, build up a body of what you regard as trusted sources, and always be aware that you need to ask yourself the question whenever a statement is made, in whatever medium it is, you have to ask the question, how do they know that? How does the broadcaster, how does the journalist feel confident enough to say that? Is he showing the evidence to back it up, or is he just making a statement in a kind of free-floating way?
When you bring this point up, and there are two different things, but even growing up, I remember as a child, we would say when the old-timers were listening to classic music, they would reference, you don't know anything about this. This is real music. And we were like, no, you don't know about music. And we'll give them some, you know, upbeat music and things like that. And now as I am aging, I can listen to music and some of these kids are listening to other tunes. I'm like, you don't know about music. So it's funny how you reference understanding, trusting, and researching, but there's a certain feel to it as well. There's an honor that comes through this work. And I can hear that from you in that it's not only about a person sounding correct, it's being able to trust that person and have that carry with them. So thank you for, you know, lightening up our ears about the knowledge of that. Let's talk about why we're really here. Coming soon, and I'm so excited to really start talking about this as one of the first people that you know will be speaking to in so many ways and form. Let's talk about your memoir. It's such a beautiful told story of your life. A Question of Paternity, My Life as an Unaffiliated Reporter. How do you feel about this soon to be released? How does that make you feel?
Well, it's been a long time coming. It's taken me about 6 years to write, 7 years maybe. And to be perfectly honest, it's possibly the most difficult thing I've ever done. I have a career now, which is, I guess, half a century long. And there's a pat phrase amongst old-timer journalists like me, which is that, you know, we write about everything from the local sewing circle to the great conferences of state. And we can also throw in, as well as that, wars and revolutions that I've covered too, and natural disasters of a few huge and terrifying nature. And that's kind of easy in a way. In the sense that I've got practiced at it, and I can do it. I know what I'm doing. Something massive and very daunting happened when I decided to write this book. I was writing about myself, not about any of these big things or even the small things. Whatever they were not me. And now I have had to write about myself. And I perfectly honestly, I can't say that it was easy. It was not. It was possibly, as I say, the most difficult kind of writing I've ever done.
Mm. For us who are eagerly waiting for this drop and for the opportunity to touch base with a well-known journalist as yourself, here you are, as you mentioned, something that is not as difficult because being in the line of fire and potential bombs around you and all these other things that may take place, letting us into your life, was that the most difficult part of it? Or is it the story itself for you to just get up and say, I'm ready to write about this?
Yeah, I'd say it's a bit of both. I was saying earlier on that I'm reserved by nature. This is a little odd, perhaps, for someone who has to be outgoing all the time as a broadcaster. So it's just difficult to even consider me as a subject to write about. And then I did find the actual subject matter difficult to disentangle, difficult to deal with. As a as a hunt. I mean, it is in some ways it is a quest sort of story. The very search was difficult, and I had to be I had to be particularly careful about how I recorded how I was searching. I had to take very rigorous notes about every new lead I followed up. But that's to be expected. If I'm going to write something, I need to apply all the professional tools that I possess to making sure that it's as accurate as I can make it. But also to make it emotionally honest to the way that I was feeling about what I was discovering. That was important as well.
It's a tribute to you, obviously, and for anyone who takes on such a journey. Tell us a little bit about this quest, because this was like no other. Not only are you peeking into your life, but you have to become this investigator. And I know that you've done investigative journalism before. This is a different type of investigation now. Walk us a little bit through that.
Sure. Well, the basic thing is that I didn't know who my father was. My mother wouldn't tell me. I never told me for a long time. As a child, I think I was in some kind of unspoken way, because I don't remember ever being told this out loud, but in some kind of unspoken way, I was warned away from the topic. I was warned off it. And I don't remember ever asking the question. I don't remember the subject ever being talked about in our household. It was a household presided over by my grandmother. We lived in a small town or a large village in the English-Scottish border country. We were poor. We were living in public housing. My grandmother had lost her husband 10 years before, thereabouts. She was widowed. She had three children in the home still. She had given birth to 10 children. One died in childbirth. Another was killed in the Second World War. But there were three younger ones in the home. My mother, who was 15 at the time we're talking about, and two younger brothers of hers who seemed to be brothers of mine. Now, that's how this story begins. I was born, and I wasn't ever told who my father was. I've been able to piece all of this together, my mother got pregnant at the age of 15. This was horribly scandalous in the village, evidently. And my grandmother allowed me into the house as a baby under certain terms and conditions.
Mm.
And one of them, there were two in particular. One specifically about me and the other more about my mother. One condition was that my mother should give up her education. She was a high school girl. Unlike many of the other villagers, she'd gone on to a secondary education. Most girls of her age at that time would stop education at about 11 or 12. But she was at high school at the nearby city. But the deal was, and it was a deal, she could bring me into the house if she went out to work and became our household's only breadwinner. She would have to go to work in the city. She worked in a bookseller's as a clerk. And the other condition was that I should be passed off as a baby as my grandmother's last child. It's just extraordinary because, I mean, it's almost ludicrous to think that they might get away with this, because my grandmother was well into her 50s by that point. And as I say, her husband was long dead. But as was explained to me later, you know, that's not uncommon, that kind of cover story for an embarrassing the embarrassing appearance of a new child in the family who was born out of wedlock, as I was. That's the situation that I faced, and that was the situation that I was trying, as a very much older adult, to disentangle when I started this whole exercise of trying to find out who my father was.
You know, these milestones that you probably had to skip and not live out a certain way because you knew there were some truths to these lies, if you will, and you had opportunities to discover them on your own. You couldn't really press too much. Sounds like mom had to step up her game to relieve herself of this as well, because this burden that she had to carry was a beautiful son who she had to deny, so to speak, and to keep or cope. Sounds like she had to continue to work tirelessly. Like, I'll sign on to this. And I could just think about if we were flies on the wall to hear the planning of this during this time. Well, this is what you're going to do. This is what you're going to say. And this is what this looks like. But as you're growing up, how was that for you? Understanding, like, wait, something is particularly not right here. And how does this work out for you?
Yes, it's an interesting question. As I say, the subject never came up in so many words. But I think I was left with a great sense of puzzlement. And as I say, it was something that I couldn't break. It wasn't a puzzle that I could solve. And so I'm speculating now. I'm not a psychiatrist. But I think I internalized this command, really, to never bring it up. And I think I told myself I wasn't interested. I didn't want to know. Although on some level I knew that wasn't true. I knew there was a mystery here, and I didn't like it, and I wanted it to be solved. But I never took any steps to do so. I never asked the question out loud. I never pressed my mother to tell me who my father was. I mean, inevitably, because it's not the sort of lie that you can maintain, that fiction that I was my mother's sister and not her son crumbled eventually. I'm not sure when. I'm guessing, but I would think it probably became clear to me. There was no speaking of it out loud once again, but I guess the awareness just grew in me that yes, she's my mother, and these two little boys, and oh, not so little, they looked big to me. They were 8 and 10 years older than me. Were not my brothers; they were my uncles. And you know, as I grew up, I called them uncle, but I called my mother and have continued right through her life, all of our life, to call her Hilda, because that's how it was in the house. I called the person who was my mother by her first name, as if she was my sister, and I called my grandmother Mam, which is the Scottish way of saying mom.
Mm. For you, it sounds like this is totally different than, you know, when someone is adopted and they're like, well, I'm going to seek who my biological parents are. This is a little bit different, way different, and that you had to endure that, and we're sending positive energy your way. Obviously, this thought process is lifelong. And as you're going out mentoring and telling people about a story, not a story that you investigated, your own story that you had to unpack. Sounds like there are layers and layers about this. Was there any resentment towards mom throughout this journey, or were you just...
I think there would inevitably have been. I would have told you at the time that I was fine with it all, and it didn't matter to me. I said that to myself many times over, I think, in my youth and in my early adulthood. It's interesting. The other thing you need to know about me is that one of the ways that I dealt with all this uncertainty, I'm not suggesting this is the only reason that I took the course that I did, but the course, one of the things that is undeniable about my life is that I became an alcoholic. I was entirely dependent upon alcohol and some other drugs too. But it was a very effective way of dulling my feelings of uncertainty and anxiety. And as a consequence, I think, I was able, not very comfortably, but kind of rather effectively, put myself away from having to deal with this difficult and intractable problem.
You know,
it's a problem of identity. I mean, it's something that it's so visceral and internal to me that I'm astonished that I was able to keep it at bay. But I have to be honest and say that alcohol helped.
Mm. And listen, you have a story to tell, and this needs to be told. And many a times we run into situations as such, and we understand that substances do help us cope. And I read early on about this and this heavy drinking with some occasional this and that. But that, to me, was the only way that you had to vent and, you know, isolate yourself and shut down. You had these bargaining, like this grieving that you had to go through. And through these stages, it sounds like you had to understand how to effectively do that. But some way, somehow, you get out of this and now you go into journalism. How is that now that you are effective in coping, but now you get into the work? How do you begin to do this?
Do you mean the work of finding out the truth about my father?
No, just the media work, because now you have decades long. This is like a 30-year trek that you're running around, making sure that you're concise, because you're bowling out.
Dead right. I started at the age of 19, being very concise and precise and double checking everything I say before I say it. That's quite a practice to get into. I mean, I wouldn't have it any other way. It's a wonderful job. I've been able to watch history in the making and be a frontline witness to it all. And it's the best, I would have told you at the time that I was having the best life imaginable. And in many ways it was. I mean, I got to see some amazing things. I got to see some terrible things. But I built up a way of essentially doing what I remember I found myself doing as a teenager and found it so remarkably fulfilling. It wasn't actually journalism. It was something else. And you might be interested in this, Jules. I became at 16 as a summer job. Actually, more as several vacation times, not just that one summer. There were other times when I did the same job through 16 to late 17, almost 18, when I did the same job. I was a junior librarian in the public library system of the city in which I was living by then, Manchester, in England. And I didn't like dealing with the public all that much because of the shyness and nervousness I've been telling you about. On the other hand, one thing that I learned suddenly was a great thing to do. People, particularly in poor working class districts like the one I was living in, would use the public library as a kind of information service. People would come in with problems with their rent, problems with their landlord in other ways, perhaps taxation problems, and they'd ask. I was 16 years old, but they'd say, "How can we deal with this problem in our lives?" And I found a quick pattern for dealing with that. I would say, "Well, frankly, I don't know, but I know where to find out." And then I'd go to the stacks in my library, and I'd consult the reference books, and I'd come back with a suggestion for these people. And in a way, that's, I think, how I ended up in journalism. I mean, apart from the other reason I mentioned before, to try and overcome my shyness. But the whole idea of being able to respond to a question that's in the air, finding out an answer, and then delivering it to the public was essentially what I was doing all my working life as a journalist.
Incredible. And now people just say, Dr. Google, figure out everything.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, sometimes it will. Sometimes it will, but there are sometimes things that are a little bit more complicated and you need a good trusted guide to take you through it.
I want you to help us understand, now that you are in this journey, you're working, you're active, but you're still on your quest. How are you balancing all of this? Still are on your path to find out who your real dad is. Walk us through those areas of challenges.
One thing that's true is that I had to get sober first. And I did, thank goodness. I was 42 years old when I finally got sober, and I've stayed sober. And it's a blessing.
Mm.
And once I got sober, various things happened, which will be no surprise to anyone who's been on the same journey. I wanted to be rid of the evasions and the lies and the habit of lying that I'd picked up myself. I wouldn't lie in my journalism, but I would lie in my private life. I would make up things about who my father had been. I would do, if not lie, certainly evade the topic whenever it came up when people were asking me. And that kind of dodging and weaving that I'd spent 4 decades of my life doing had to end, I thought. Living an honest life is the probably the strongest way of supporting a decision to no longer drink alcohol or take drugs. Look at life square on and deal with it in all its reality rather than trying to avoid it. So that meant I had to get rid of this terrible cloud that I found myself under when it came to my own family. The relationship between myself and my mother was in this strange, clouded, and rather stilted affair. We never really had what I would call a mother and son relationship. I think it was almost doomed from the start by this strange myth that I was growing up in the midst of, pretending, having to pretend to be her sister, pretending to be her brother and not her son. So at the age of 42, the prescription for myself now is honesty. And in the process of that, let's get rid of this lie or this total evasion of the truth, which is who was my father. And that's when I started to ask my mother out loud. And that's when she started to evade that word again, started to evade the issue. And I tried to do it delicately considerately and caringly, but I did press the issue, and eventually, in rather strange circumstances that involved an ancient communication device, now a fax. She sent me a fax to tell me what she said was the truth. It rather dates me. That's the medium by which we were communicating. But that's how it was. And the facts said, I know you only want a name. And here it is. The man was Father Francis. He was a Roman Catholic priest who raped me when I was an innocent schoolgirl of 15. He was sent away from the village. I don't know where. That's all I know. And she just signed it, Hilda, her name. And that was when my world was rocked. I had an explanation for who had fathered me. And it was shocking.
In this sense of honesty in your trek, in your sense of resilience, obviously looking early on, I don't want to give too much away, but just as mom is liked by Father Francis, if you will, you start thinking about the church trust, because she wasn't of that. She was of a different religious or belief or denomination. She wasn't thinking about that, but just her politeness and like innocentness. And Father Francis, in all due respect, you know, groomed her in so many ways to keep her as the way that he did, and still in all, even after the fact, you know, mom's ability to have to deal with this and have to, you know, pursue her life in a different track. She probably had dreams of her own in different ways, and she had to do that. So very difficult to kind of speak about it. And I'm sure you have other platforms to really delve in, but I really want to know, after you find out the truth of who he is, what do you do next? Do you look for him? Do you stay put? What's your next move?
Well, that was my mother's story. And I decided that the obvious thing to do, I mean, I did kick in with all my journalistic juices flowing. And I used all my kit bag of professional tools as a journalist. I tried to find this Father Francis. It was a difficult search. I got a lot of help. I got help through priests I knew. I should say, sexual abuse in the Catholic Church is not news. It's and at that time that I learned this information, just as the new century was dawning. It was in the year 2001. The whole story, if you like, of sexual abuse of minors, boys and girls, by priests was a very hot running story in Britain, in Ireland, in North America, in the United States and Canada, and in Australia and many places, and lots of countries in Africa too. So this story seemed to fit into that whole pattern. So one of the things I knew, and I was certainly advised by my colleagues who knew the Catholic Church much better than I did, although ironically enough, my career at a fairly early point turned out to be specializing in religion matters and ethical matters. So I had some contacts in that world, and I was given help by some of those contacts. Some of them were in the church. Some of them were in the law enforcement field in Britain. It was important to me that I conduct this search through these contacts. In other words, I was doing it at something of a remove. They were doing the legwork while I was not getting directly involved, because I had been warned by my professional colleagues who knew the field well that if I just knock on the front door of the church and ask for the information as a journalist in the normal way, lots of people's experiences at the church authorities are very good at concealing stories like this and blurring the record, and quite often falsifying records. So I had to do it carefully. It was one of those investigative exercises that I was used to in other fields. But it was kind of strange having to employ all those tactics for my own story. But the interesting thing is, all these contacts came up with nothing. Mm. We couldn't find Father Francis. There was one priest who appeared to fit the bill in many ways. The circumstantial evidence was pretty clear. He disappeared about the time that I was born from the public record, and then changed his name, which previously had been Francis, to another part of his name. His full name was Francis Leo. And when he reappeared in the record a couple of years later, he's known as Father Leo. So this could be, we all thought, this could be our man. Yeah. Hmm. I mean, using the language of criminal investigations now. There he was up on the wall of evidence and connections, and he died in another part of the diocese in which the original Father Francis would have been part of the staff of a parish church. And of course, the other line of inquiry that was inevitable now that we were in the 21st century was the modern miracle of DNA, genetic investigation through that means. So, and I had given my DNA samples to something like a dozen of these genealogical websites that depend upon DNA samples for their connections to be made. So I was in a bunch of databases that amounted to several million people. Wow. We were hoping that this would lead to a connection that would, in the end, identify people who might be related to my father at the very least. But one of the first things that came out of this area was a negative finding. The Father Leo Francis that we had tracked down by all the other circumstantial evidentiary means was not any relation to me, whatever. We had no DNA in common at all.
Oh.
So that was the end of that line of inquiry.
Mm. And as you continue to go, how frustrating is this? Not your man.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But as you're doing this, and you are learning about yourself, because there's a certain aspect about you that you did not know, that you were starting to explore and find out, because now you're sober, there's honesty to lead you. You're patient. There was a lot of that in you, maybe from your training and skill, but there was some sense of you that there was a clinical aspect to this that you understood, that you had to cure yourself, not like you used to. You had to find ways to cope. What were some of the tools that you will use throughout your journey to keep you sane, if you will?
Well, interestingly, you're right. Journalism helped. There have been many inquiries that I've conducted in different matters, political scandals, for instance, excuse me, certain business stories I've done, stories of business corruption, in which I've had to be very slow in my approach and very canny, as we say in Scotland. And you're right, very patient. And I kind of surprised myself. It was interesting as I was writing the book, many a chapter will begin about how impatient I am for a result here. But the truth is, I was practicing patience. I may not have wanted to, but I ended up doing so. And all in all, it's been a search that has been a quarter of a century long. My search effectively began in earnest 25 years ago, and here I am. I mean, I'm not going to give a spoiler for readers of the book, but here I am, and the search goes on.
Let's talk about the patience of journalism. even though that now technology with the blink of an eye, with the click of a finger, you get so much information. For those investigative journalists who are probably not investigating this type of story, but who are investigating and need to be patient, what are some advice you have for them?
Gosh, I wouldn't presume to give advice. There's a very kind comment on the book that's already been published. The comment has been published before the book's published. Carl Bernstein, one of my journalistic heroes, I think, his work with Bob Woodward, which led to the toppling of President Nixon in the Watergate scandal. In a way, his work was inspiring for me in 1974, inspiring me to become the kind of journalist I became. But he's read the book, Carl Bernstein has, and he says a few very kind words. He's described it as an exceptional memoir, moving, shocking, heroic. And I think, I haven't talked to him about it, but I think what he means by that is that there's some fellow journalistic thinking going on here. He recognizes that there's a lot of very painstaking, slow, dogged investigative work that has gone into this book. And he's right. I have to, I don't want to be immodest about it, but there's a lot of journalistic work that has gone into this book. And as you say, it involves a lot of patience. And I suppose if I was to be asked by, if you think of it as a series of layers with a very experienced investigative journalist like Carl at the top of the mountain, if you like, and lower down the pyramid, there's me working away in the way that I do. And if I was to be any kind of a mentor for aspiring journalists, as indeed I was very directly for a while, I taught broadcast news and documentary making at Columbia Journalism School. And if I were to be doing that job again now, and I was to be asked how to, what were the basic principles to abide by when you're doing investigative journalism, I probably would say that, be dogged, be go in for a long slog if you have to, and you very often do have to, and most of all, for all the insistence that might be in your mind, you still practice patience, and don't go running off to the first fast hare that breaks out of the gate and starts running. Be careful, and of course, weigh everything carefully before you put anything into the public domain.
Beautifully said. And just to, like, I always tell people, you can't handle the truth. This is one of them.
The truth is a very hard thing to identify to begin with. And then when you've got it, it's very hard to handle. You're right.
It is something. You have done so much, a beautiful career, and it's such an honor to have met you and to learn about this. And thank you so much for sharing. You've seen so much good, bad, and different in so many ways. Is there a story that really has impacted you throughout all these years that sometimes you're just probably driving, sitting down and reading a book, you're, oh my God, you're thinking about it again, it just pops up for you, or that it motivates you? Is there such a story that you think about, not related to your own personal story, that you can share with us that maybe sounds like, I always think about this and it really shaped me to be who I am now?
I spent a lot of my life in Southern Africa, the liberation struggles of that part of the world, I think, made a huge impact upon me. South Africa in particular, but also Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Angola, and that whole stretch of the world in which white supremacy clung on into the late latter part of the 20th century. Long, you know, the liberation was long overdue, but liberation eventually came, and the honor that I felt in being able to chart that course of liberation being fought for and eventually won is one of the greatest things that I can say about my my working life. And it is the story that comes back to me again and again. I once had a kind of argument, I guess it was an argument, with Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa. We used to have what we'd call our catch-up interviews. Every now and again, we'd just sit down and record, either on radio or on television, an interview about how things are going with the liberation struggle. And then after that, how freedom was going after Nelson Mandela had been freed from prison. There were elections, the first ever free democratic elections in 1994, and Nelson Mandela became President Nelson Mandela, the first mm-hmm. black president of a black majority nation. But at the time that Desmond and Archbishop Tutu and I were talking, I'm remembering one conversation in particular, one of these interviews that we did periodically. It was at that teetering point after Nelson Mandela had been released from prison and negotiations were going on with the white supremacists who were still in control, between the white supremacists and his party, the ANC, the African National Congress. And although history records that as a very peaceful transition now to President Mandela being the man in charge and the ANC being the duly elected government from then on, it was in fact a very tense time.
Mm.
And Tutu and I were talking at that moment. And I remember saying, Well, first of all, you should recognize how tense a time it was. Political murders were going on at an extraordinary rate. One of the ANC men that I had gotten to know quite well was killed by a white supremacist gunman. Mm-hmm. Chris Hani, another one of those very effective liberation fighters, was also killed. And there were bombs, of course, being planted by white extremists right in the middle of Johannesburg. So it was a much tenser time than we now remember. But in the midst of it, the big question for the ANC was, how do we ensure that the anger? Why wouldn't there be anger? Why make sure that the anger of people who have been suppressed for 300 years doesn't overflow into mass revenge? And Tutu was telling me that he had complete faith that Nelson Mandela would lead the nation to a peaceful transition. And I remember saying, why do you think that? Look out the window now. A bomb had just gone off. Things are not anywhere near approaching a peaceful transition. And he said, David, you should never underestimate the power of prayer.
Mm.
And I said, being the arrogant young man I was, I said, "Oh, look, I at that stage I hadn't yet met Mandela personally, but I felt that I knew a lot about him. I'd certainly interviewed many people who knew him, his family, his colleagues, his then wife, his doctor." And I said, "Archbishop, I don't think I know from people who are in prison with Mandela. Mandela is not a praying man. I don't think he's even a Christian. And Tutu was still smiling, still shaking his head at me. And he said, David, I wasn't talking about Mandela. There were millions of people praying for a peaceful outcome to this struggle.
Mm.
So that was me put in my place by the Archbishop.
Wow.
The struggle was that of the people. And in the end, it was the people, aided by prayer in many cases, who set the agenda for a peaceful transition.
Funny enough, you use a name that we all can connect to, but it's really the power of all of us, because we're just as strong as one if we all can unite. Before we let you go, the floor is yours. Any parting words about you, the movement, your next steps, and journalism as a whole? Such a pleasure, David. Take us away.
I just want to carry on doing what I do, which is to critique the work of journalists like myself, keep ourselves honest. TheMediaBeat.us is my weekly commentary on coverage of seismic events that are going on right now. But we need good journalism, and I encourage journalists to be as good as they possibly can. And I want to keep on doing that job of elevating the good work and criticizing the bad work, such as it is.
You know, I learned from you so much today. I'm going to use your words to probably say, I don't know, but I know where to find out. And many a times we get ourselves caught up in situations because oftentimes we don't understand who we are until we go out and find out. Such a beautiful story is yours, David, and I'm so honored to have had you. I want everyone to know that truth be told, whether others choose to see it or listen to it, these lips, they were made for talking, because on this platform it was built, because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled, but this is no longer. Our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Thank you, dear friend.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just. At He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa, this is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde De La Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, Mamá. Te extraño mucho.